Support for today's episode of Script Apart comes from We Screenplay. If you've just completed a draft of a script and are wondering what next, well, you need to check out We Screenplay. We Screenplay not only offers amazing free resources, like virtual events where your questions are answered by Hollywood's leading professionals, with incredible 72-hour turnaround, format-specific feedback tailored to your specific goals, and a price that no one else can come close to, We Screenplay coverage is used by thousands of writers in every phase of their careers, from emerging writers still finding their voice all the way to Oscar winners. So if your script is all ready to go, check out one of We Screenplay's labs, where dozens of writers have been repped, optioned, and staffed as a direct result of the real-life industry meetings and hands-on workshops offered by We Screenplay. Don't stay stuck. We Screenplay want to help. Check out We Screenplay by visiting wescreenplay.com or clicking the link in today's show notes. Support for this episode also comes from our friends at Screencraft. Breaking into Hollywood as an aspiring writer can be a confusing, convoluted thing. Fortunately, Screencraft is here to help writers with both the craft of writing and the business of Hollywood. Screencraft has everything for your writing journey, from video lectures starring your favorite writers to hands-on career coaching with their excellent writer development team. These guys offer the best screenwriting competitions designed to help your talent shine, featuring judges that really know their genre, from top literary reps to Oscar-winning screenwriters. Hundreds of past winners and finalists have started their careers with the direct support of Screencraft. Winners have been staffed on shows at Netflix, Amazon, Apple TV+, the list goes on. They've also sold scripts and been hired to write films for the likes of Universal, Lionsgate, Blumhouse, and Hulu. So if you're an aspiring writer, what are you waiting for? Don't wait to check out Screencraft today. Visit screencraft.org or click the link in today's show notes. Hey Script Apart listeners, welcome back to another episode of this podcast about the first draft secrets of great films and TV shows. My name's Al Horner, and today on the show, another in our Stage Apart mini-series devoted to unraveling the first draft secrets of great theatre productions. The immensely talented Jez Butterworth is my guest this week, a storyteller whose 2009 play Jerusalem is frequently referred to as one of the best plays of the century so far. His other acclaimed theatre productions include 1995's Mojo, 2012's The River, and 2019's The Ferryman, but film fans might know him better for successes like Edge of Tomorrow, Ford vs. Ferrari, the James Bond movie Spectre, and Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. Recently, Jez made his triumphant return to the West End with The Hills of California, directed by Sam Mendes. It tells the tale of a group of sisters reuniting in the faded seaside town that they grew up in, where they once aspired towards musical stardom. Decades after the death of that particular dream, they're left to reckon with what their lives became versus what they once imagined for themselves, with one painful secret no longer able to be confined to the past. It's an incredibly moving and at times hilarious meditation on regret, Britishness, and the vultures that circle showbiz, inspired in part by Jez's run-in with disgraced producer Harvey Weinstein, who the playwright once punched in the face. In this conversation you're about to hear, which is completely spoiler-free, we get into what it is that Jez finds so captivatingly tragic about Death of a Dream stories. We discuss how the experience of losing his own beloved sister informed the play, and have an honest, vulnerable chat about a period of Jez's life in which his mental health was suffering, and how that intersected with the experience of working on Edge of Tomorrow. A massive thank you to Jez for his time, and a huge shout out also to our Patreon supporters, without whom this show would not be possible. If you like what we do on Script Apart and want to see the show continue to grow, you can join that community by visiting patreon.com/scriptapart, where for the price of a single monthly cup of coffee, you'll get ad-free episodes, early access to episodes, the chance to ask your questions to upcoming guests, and much more. That address one more time in case you're interested, it's patreon.com/scriptapart. Okay, with that all out the way, let's dive in. This is the fantastic Jez Butterworth discussing the first draft secrets of The Hills of California. Thanks so much for tuning in, everyone. You're listening to Script Apart, hosted by me, Al Horner, produced by Camille Demet. Hey, Jez, so great to have you with us. Welcome to Script Apart. How's it going today?
Good. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. We are speaking a month or so after The Hills of California opened in London. It really is such an achievement, Jez. I loved this story. It rattled me in ways I was not ready for. I know your plays often take quite a long time to materialize on the page after conception. Often that gestation period is a decade or more. From the sounds of things, this was no different. This was about 9 years in the making. Have I got that right?
Yeah, in the making is an odd way to put it because I don't really do much. I just sort of try and avoid it. It's the opposite of what you'd expect. Like you might think that one would start to research it or start to delve into it. And I don't. I just sort of try and pretend it didn't happen and then see if it's still there in 6 months' time. And the only things I pursue are the ones which are.
That makes sense, yeah. Like in the past, you know, you have kind of half jokingly blamed that long gestation period on how hard it is to write plays, which is fair. But I am curious, Jez, when you look back on your body of work at this point and you kind of see the caliber of writing of these plays, do you see qualities that are only there because of how long you've allowed them to percolate? I think so many writers, myself included, have this real tendency to feel like once they've had an idea, they're in a bit of a race with themselves to turn it into a script, as if the idea will lose its luster somehow if you don't kind of find some momentum for it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think that's the perceived wisdom, isn't it? That you've got to sort of strike while the iron is hot. And I just completely disagree with that, certainly in terms of plays, because I feel like, you know, it's one of the reasons why I'm not on any social media, is that the thing I just thought of just there and then, which entertains me, delights me, and seems like it fills my world, the next morning you sort of wish you hadn't done it. You know, it's only the things which really, really endure that interest me on the stage. And then I think you stand a hope of hitting a resonance, a vibe, a kind of a frequency that perhaps was there before you even thought of the idea.
Well, this story in particular, Jez, is another story about the death of a dream. Would-be stars who aspire to musical fame and fortune in a 1950s show business that's kind of full of vultures ready to descend upon their talent. That's obviously something that you explored in a very different register, a very different tone, in your first play, Mojo. And I wondered what it is about that compels you. Like, as an audience, there's something so tragic and infuriating and captivating and also so true about watching young people with aspirations of stardom kind of bump up against the violent reality of the machines that facilitate that stardom. As their creator, what is it about these types of stories that speaks to you?
Well, you know, first thing to say is I managed to get all the way through writing The Hills of California without making that observation myself, which really surprised me. It's incredible how thick I can, you can have such a perspective on the subject and none at all. Because even it being set, you know, mostly in the, or partly in the 50s, you know, I didn't manage to make the leap. Not that it's much of one to make. I think as a subject, I think I am haunted by dreams and aspirations and whether they come off and what it means if they do, what it means if they don't. And I think that it's something that I haven't grown out of. And I'm going back to Mojo, you know, I wrote that at a time where I was imagining what that world was like. And it was, you know, and I made a film of that. And so Howard Pinter was in it, playing a predator, a sexual predator. And I wrote the scene just as I imagined it to be, with no experience of it at all. And it was only about 6 months after that that the movie was screened, and it was screened to Miramax, and Harvey Weinstein was sitting watching that scene. And he, at that point in the film, he got up and he walked out. And I didn't know why. at that point. I had no idea why. So yeah, so I don't know. The death of dreams is something that has definitely occupied me, and I don't really know why. I mean, I was asked this question yesterday, and somebody said, "What business have you got worrying about the death of dreams? It's all gone your way." And I'm not sure. I don't know. I'm not sure that's really how it works, is it? I mean, I think you could make a case to the fact that it's all gone my way because I'm so terrified of it not doing. You know, that doesn't make it not an obsession. But yeah, it has been, and it remains so. I think there is something to sit in an audience and explore somebody or people on the stage enacting the difficult, dignified climb down from what they hoped would happen and what is happening is one of the most compelling subjects of drama. It's death of a salesman, you know, it's somebody, you know, it's at the absolute beating heart of that is a man who has dreams for himself and his children, which have failed to materialize. And as he feels that there's no plug in the sink and all the water's running away, the dance that he performs is the stuff of tragedy. And so really that's, I think I'm in an area where there's, you know, there's gold in them, there, hills.
Hills being an operative word there. Speaking of kind of echoes of your past work that may or may not exist in this play, Jez, you know, you obviously kind of wrote Jerusalem 15 years ago or so, and there's an echo of that play in the way that The Hills of California kind of zeroes in on a certain British drabness and dilapidation, that the kind of Blackpool of this story is a tatty, faded postcard of a backdrop that's decidedly unglamorous in comparison to the kind of Californian holy land that the Andrews sisters dream of. Was there something that you wanted to express about Britain today through this story of Britain back then? And, well, crucially also, did you find that what you wanted to express about Britain had changed writing this play in 2024 versus when you wrote Jerusalem in a very different time for the country, pre-Brexit and pre so many other huge changes to UK life?
It's a really good question. I think that the different versions of England that I've written, they kind of come naturally. They're how I see it. You know, the Blackpool, that's how I remember it. And going there again, it is, you know, it's an unbelievably poignant landscape. I think the difference between, you know, in the 15 years since I wrote Jerusalem, my view of England has changed. My view of Britain, let's say, has changed. And not for the good. And not that it was necessarily good before, but I was certainly compelled by it in a way that it fascinated me, and I could really get the, you know, get the lungs up to sing about it that loudly. And I don't think I would now. I don't think that I could. It's not just that I couldn't write that play. I don't think I would sit down and want to. And I don't really know what that means. I just don't. I don't enjoy being here in the way that I did 15 years ago. I don't like driving through it. I don't like walking through it. I don't like talking to. I don't like hearing politicians talk about this country. I don't like the arguments that are going on about this country. I don't think it all just really depresses me, and I'm really worried for the future in that degree. I wonder whether that play, Jerusalem, was me kind of watching it go down the plug hole. Not it, my sense of it, you know, my love for it. It was, there's something I think now when I saw it again last year, it's kind of a so long toodaloo to England.
You mentioned there your memories of Blackpool. You obviously have been there, but the play takes place in a time where, you know, you weren't privy to that time. You haven't experienced that time firsthand. And that is something of a running thread in your work, Jez. You tend to gravitate seemingly towards times and places that, you know, as an audience, we haven't existed in, and as a writer, you haven't existed in. I'm curious what motivates that. Do you love the research process of immersing yourself in a period, in a culture? Is there something more colourful and exciting as a writer about kind of being able to play around with dialects and rhythms of language and social codes that aren't your own? What do you think it is that keeps you embarking upon that challenge?
I think it's all of that. But it's also, you know, Shakespeare didn't write plays set in Stratford-upon-Avon, you know. That there's a kind of a way that you can perhaps, if you think that a time and a, if you think that, say, you know, Venice and the Rialto and the world of that play is a mask that writer can put on and say things that he wouldn't be able to say otherwise, or find things, draw things out of himself or his psyche or what he shares with other psyches and sing about it, then that's what it takes to do that. You know, it's and I think that it's clearly at this point, I need to graft another world onto my own psychological crises that form a play and kind of meld the two together and watch them and see if they take off. I think that I'm aware of that now, that I won't be able to, in the near future, sit down and start writing a play about my mother. You know, I don't think so. I don't think that's going to happen. I sort of don't get that voice. But yeah, putting it together with something else and making those... I think it was Tennessee Williams said that his plays are a kind of a psychological autobiography, but none of the events that happened in them you could absolutely say for sure happened to him. I know that when I sit down to write a play, that unconsciously they end up being 7 or 8 things I can't bear to look at, that I kind of throw together in the dark and try and process in some sort of way, and it comes out as a play. I imagine people who write songs go through a similar thing. It's like, I don't really know what it is I'm going to say here, but I know what I don't want to say, and write that. And so I can identify all kinds of strands in the hills of California, strands and things that you know, I could on a piece of paper sit down and say these are the things that I'm terrified of, or terrified of losing, or have lost. I can see what they are and how they found their way into the play. And I think that's why I choose away games.
That makes a lot of sense, and it rings true with what I know about the kind of inspirations behind the hills of California, Jez. I understand that, you know, behind this story of sibling loss and sibling grief, there was your own experience, and I'm really sorry to hear that was something you went through. Can you talk to me about, like, yeah, the kind of process of identifying that thing that you're terrified of and then building it out into this story that lives and breathes as its own thing? Like, how do you kind of tend to kind of first identify the thing you want to write about and then begin to assemble all the pieces of the story in front of you?
Well, I think the first thing you need is a strong stomach. You know, you do need to be able to handle the pain of it. You know, you've got to be able to look at it. I think in most circumstances outside of writing, people don't want to do that. You know, you don't want to put your hand in the fire. And I think that my writing got good when I realized that was the price of entry. That's what I was going to have to do if I didn't want to end up with stuff that was just, I think Miles Davis said there are only two types of song. He said there's the blues and there's zippity-doo-dah. And I think that unless you're going to do what I'm saying, you need to do. You get zippity-doo-dah. Now, zippity-doo-dah can be beautiful. It can be absolutely wonderful. It can be, you can go back and attend it again and again, but it's not what I wanted to do. And so I knew that it was going to involve a kind of a bloody-mindedness and a fearlessness and a kind of a sense that I was going to dive in and dive down there in the dark and see what I could come up with. When I really committed to that, around about the time that I wrote Parlour Song and then wrote Jerusalem and the River and the Ferryman, around that time, it's no exaggeration to say that I was in peril, that decision to try and look at stuff in that way stood a fairly good chance that it was going to annihilate me. Because you kind of go, there's a cigarette paper between those states of grace and states of complete madness. And I felt like I crossed it pretty swiftly, probably too swiftly. And things in my life and in my psychological health became really, really dicey. And the water became very, very choppy and hard to navigate. And sometimes I'm amazed that I survived it.
What pulled you back, Jez?
I don't know. I really don't know, because it's not like I've looked away from it. I don't really know. I'm trying to work that out. I can't really, really, really say. I do know that it was really, really close, a hop, skip and a jump from being balmy, you know, from being properly mad, from seeing from perceiving patterns where none existed, from seeing and feeling intimations and presences which you couldn't explain. And kind of just really flipped out into this, you know, there's a sense, I think, looking back on the register that some of those plays take place in, I don't think anything that I'm saying comes as a surprise. But it's, you know, I think it's a way of explaining why it is that writers get to a point, they approach a point where their skill, their technique coincides with a moment of seeing, and one can hold hands with the other and create something that I think is worth it. And I think, yeah, it was Jackson Pollock said technique is just a means of arriving at a statement. And I think that this is the only thing that I think can explain why a lot of writers in all fields get to a point where they'll make, for want of a better word, a sublime statement and won't be able to repeat it. They're still the same person. They've got the same skills. If anything, they know more than they did before they attempted this, but it never repeats itself. Now, that suggests that they're passing through some kind of psychological state that is only, that's quite rarefied, and that is only attainable through a certain number of bets that you will make with yourself. And you can liken that to going to the crossroads. Now, you can liken that to going to the crossroads and making a infernal pact. It's the same metaphor. I will now bet absolutely everything I have, my soul and my salts, on being able to play like a motherfucker.
That's so beautiful. I am curious though, Jez, like what role writing has in helping you kind of navigate those choppy waters you spoke of. You are someone who threads so much of your own life into your plays and into your stories. Like The Ferryman may have been set in an environment you didn't grow up in, but some of the stories about your mother and different things are pulled directly from your life. Does writing a play like The Hills of California, which, as I mentioned, was kind of, you know, rooted in sibling grief, Does that help kind of soothe something? Does it help you exercise something? What's the catharsis that you get out of writing that helps with that journey?
So here's the real bummer. It doesn't. It's never really helped. I don't feel afterwards like I built a bonfire and expunged something, so that I could get round it. I think quite the opposite. In some ways, what I've tended to do, this exact opposite, what I've tended to do is go back and reenact what happens in the play. I can't really escape it. It doesn't really, I don't think the ultimate benefit is a kind of is a catharsis for the person that creates it. I'm not sure that after John Lennon writes Julia, he's all right with his mum. I think that it's just allows other people to feel that. But I think that the person who writes it is marooned in exactly the same state.
There is a bit of distance, obviously, from your own experience in that this is a decidedly female-focused story to an almost like comical degree. Like the male characters, with one or two obvious exceptions, they're mostly these kind of dozy guys who are relegated to running errands for their partners. And, your plays previously have really grappled with masculinity. Was there kind of an active sense of wanting to tell a female-led story, or did that just happen accidentally, Jez?
I think it happened accidentally. I mean, I think that this has been a process I've been going through for years. The Ferryman, which is 7 years old, that three of the actresses in that were nominated for Olivier Awards. And I was really proud of that because suddenly I was writing, meaningful parts that weren't to be played by men. But so it wasn't a wildly conscious thing. My life has changed. There is kind of a game of two halves. The first half was male and the second half is mostly female. I've got four daughters and you're the first man I've spoken to for days. it's just kind of what the sound that you're surrounded by. It's incredible also how quickly women forget that you're the only man in the room. They do. They just forget you're there and they just carry on regardless. And you get to kind of see a way of them being with each other that you don't see if you're one of three or four men. And so that's been a shock and a privilege. I feel like the fact that the men in the play are these kind of half men came about because of the fact that Gloria and Ruby, by their own admission, have settled for half. And so you're not going to end up with, I think she says at one point that her husband was born on the exact same day as Marlon Brando, and there the comparison comes to a shuddering halt. She's chosen people she's chosen a string, a sad conga of men who won't leave her. And she's gone from one to the other, safe in the knowledge that her heart will not be in peril. And so there's a conversation at the beginning of Act Three between these two husbands who sort of make up almost the man between them. And their conversation is sandwiched in between these two unbelievably visceral moments. One of them being just pre-rock and roll, which is young Joan. And one of them being post-rock and roll, which is when she re-enters the house, having been on a journey that none of them could they could only get off of records. And so those men aren't there for us just to put on the end of a stick and laugh at. They're there to measure the distance between the audience and the artist or the would-be artist. Now, there's a moment where Dennis describes Ruby when they saw Little Richard on one of their first dates, and she just begs him to take her with him. And I think that the he's baffled by what that means when he says, but we just went and got chips. That he's living this life that can only sort of peer through very, very murky glass at what his dreams might have been, even if there ever were. I'm not sure Dennis was somebody who was throbbing with pipe dreams or real dreams. And so the men exist in the play in a way which I think, so on the one hand, I really enjoyed the fact that whenever a man in the play walks on stage, he's swiftly sent off the stage to go and do something. Even Mr. Halliwell, who wants to use the stage as just a place to cross to get to his room a bit quicker. So I enjoyed that, but I also positioned them in a way that made sense to the overall point I think I was trying to make, to do with lives which set off a half and one which go for the brass ring.
Yeah, if the husbands represent the kind of lives these characters have settled for, a lot of the musicians that the play invokes, they represent the kind of like glamorous American escape that these characters were never able to attain. And I'm curious, I think one of the reasons why the play struck such a nerve with me is that there's a part of me that feels in that kind of like Andrew's sister aspirational stage of life, where I'm looking as a writer to the US side of the industry, like I'm kind of having conversations in my own writing that are over in LA and all that kind of thing. And there's a kind of like fabulistic aspect to the hills of California about the kind of folly of seeing the lights of LA as this holy land and this Mecca. Can you talk to me about that, Jez? Like, was there anything from your own life and your own experience of yes, kind of having established yourself in the UK and then dabbling in Hollywood that you think either consciously or subconsciously you were kind of getting out onto the page?
Well, I think that yes, there is, and I think that it's quite simple, really. That the when I'm drawn to a dramatic subject, when something sort of gets in my bones and I can't do anything about it, it's usually because it means two things simultaneously. So it's quite a simple point I'm going to make here, which is just that I love Hollywood and I hate Hollywood. I grew up loving the idea of America and was afraid of it. And so just these simple ambiguities, these formal juxtapositions of stances to a single idea is drama. And so, yes, I feel that my experiences of what's been 25, 30 years of getting onto aeroplanes and flying out to a, like you say, a kind of a mythical terrain for a English boy from a comprehensive school in St. Albans to end up at, and to end up quite young. Yeah, it's been the most extraordinarily exciting and harrowing and basically dramatic journey. And I think a lot of that does find its way into the play. And, you know, it strikes me now that there is a reason why it is set, just to open that up a bit, there is a reason why it's set immediately before and immediately after rock and roll. You know, someone says in the 50s in this play, something like, do you know who Elvis Presley is? And she says, I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
And just the idea that yeah, just that kind of before and after with nothing in between, but a kind of a dusty jukebox with that doesn't work with these songs on it. And that be only 20 years after, you know, it's kind of incredible when you think about it, that period, you know, that's like going back to 2004, you know, and that entire cultural thing sort of happened. What that must have been like to be in. You know, my mum is would have been, you know, she was born in 43, and she would have been, you know, 25, 26 at the end of the 60s, and only 34, 35 when you know, only in her mid-30s when punk's happening. That just feels like such a short window, and I think I wanted to put that in the play. So I've rambled off there, but that's why the play is set when it's set.
You mentioned there how you both love and hate Hollywood. A lot of our listeners absolutely adore your forays into Hollywood, Jez. For example, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of Edge of Tomorrow, which is fully one of my favorite sort of sci-fi action films. If it's okay, I'd love to ask a few quick questions just about, yeah, some of your screenwriting experiences as we're primarily a screenwriting podcast. Can you tell me about, yeah, your memories of Edge of Tomorrow and the kind of biggest changes that script underwent? Because it sounds like it was, yeah, quite a complicated process.
It was. I alluded earlier to a period in my life where I went bananas, and writing Edge of Tomorrow fell squarely in the middle of that period. It was the end of 2010. My sister had just been terminally diagnosed with brain cancer, and my marriage was falling apart, and I'd just written Jerusalem, and I was in New York with Doug Liman, who I'd worked with all the way back to Mr. and Mrs. Smith. So I'd known him for about a good 7 or 8 years by then. And the wheels were coming off, you know. I was having quite a tough time of it. I remember going for lunch with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Mark Rylance. And I think Philip could see something was, he asked me what was wrong. You know, he could see something was wrong. And I had no idea what the trouble that he was in. Anyway, so I was trying to, in the middle of all of that, write this unbelievably like Chinese algebra pit of plotting that movie represents. But there is a kind of a desperate madness at the heart of that story. You know, I haven't watched it for years, but it all took place. I think it all takes place, doesn't it? In a sort of a reimagining of the D-Day landings. Now, the whole thing I was talking about earlier about taking bits of one's life and sort of repurposing them. My dad was on Omaha Beach on the 6th of June in the scenes that were recreated in Saving Private Ryan. He was in the first wave landing crafts of American soldiers. And he told me, but only years later, some of the horrific stories of what had gone on there when he was going through a breakdown. And sure enough, that's, you know, when I got my hands on that story, that was where I set it. You know, it was where me and John Henry chose to. By the way, John Henry wasn't involved in it to start with. I was doing it on my own. And it was only because John Henry has a young, agile brain and you know, and it was so difficult to hold all those bits in my head that me and Doug called him up and said, come out. And but yeah, all of that kind of that weird, nightmarish, stuck in on a wheel stuff all came out of, it wasn't made up, you know. It all came out of a real place, which I can't really identify for most of the movies that I've written. You know, I'm not going through that kind of that. I'm not going through what the characters of Ford v Ferrari are going through. Although you could make a case for that being one's experience with Hollywood from the very beginning. You know, the kind of the you know that joke about a producer and a writer and a director land on a desert island, and they find this is a mammoth joke, I think. They find an orange juice, and the writer and the director, a pint of orange juice, the director are trying to work out how to split it up between the three of them fairly. And who should get what share of the orange juice? You know, the director feels he should get the most, and the writer feels that he should get the most. And the producer says, look, here, what we'll do is we'll share it equally. But what I'm going to do first is I'm going to piss in it. And I think that is Ford v Ferrari in a nutshell, isn't it? You know, it's that they want to piss in the orange juice. Yeah, maybe there's more to that. I've always said that the films that I write are kind of a different sport. They're for, it's like the technique having fun with itself. And it is a different kind of technique. It involves a ball. But it's not the same ball as plays. And I love doing it. I really, really love doing it. And I find it, I don't feel that it takes me to, you can see by the types of films that I write that I do it for fun. You know, it's kind of like a break from what I task myself with writing a play,
yeah,
and what I task myself with writing a film don't really resemble each other. I've not really. I think there's a reason for that. I'll tell you what I think it is. It's that in the theatre, I'm in charge, and no one can tell me what to do. And so you can risk everything. You can risk putting your heart on the line. Now, if you do that in Hollywood, you're going to get it stamped on. And so I think I realized that really early on, that it was going to be too frustrating to watch committee fabricated versions of things that I felt were primal to who I was. And so it was like, well, what do you want? You know, what do you want to do? Let's find stories that I would have enjoyed when I was a kid. Let's do Indiana Jones. You know, let's do James Bond. It's great fun. It's really, really good fun doing that stuff. You know, I skip to work when I'm doing that. And I have a great day. You know, I really enjoy it. And I've, you know, and not, you know, and apart from all of that, it's biblically well rewarded financially. So, you know, so it's what's not to like. But I do think that if it was all I did, I think I would write, perhaps choose different projects and risk my lot. I'd try and direct them and be a bigger force and a bigger bastard through the process to drive through what it was that I wanted to do. But I've not had to do that because of the theatre.
Yeah. With Indy, which you mentioned there, is it you that I have to thank for the massive third act swing for the fences in that film?
Actually, I don't think it is. I think that was... What tends to happen, as you know, at the end of an Indiana Jones film is that it slips its moorings and goes off into the supernatural. They each do it. And each do it to different degrees and to different degrees of success. I think that we knew we were going to have to do it. And what they tend to do, like in the first one, it's done in a way where you almost forget that that's what's going on. You know, like don't look at the... Don't look at the casket or whatever it is, and they get it over with as quickly as they can. Jim's decision, and it was Jim's decision, to go all out into the time travel idea was really brave, was really courageous, and was really fun, I think. But I don't think it was John Henry and I driving that. I think that was Jim's brainchild.
I did love it. Jez, I should ask as well before we wrap up. We acknowledged earlier how Mojo began life on the stage and then you adapted it for the screen. Some of your work, it doesn't feel like it needs a screen adaptation, and in fact some of the things would be lost along the way if it was, like, you know, the plays in which you've used animals, for example. I think, like, you know, to watch that on screen, you don't think anything of seeing a goose on screen, but in a theater that has a whole different effect. With The Hills of California, can you ever see that kind of like becoming a film? Is that something you'd like? I think like there's a cinematic quality to the story. Is that something you kind of entertain the idea of, or is that not something you want to explore really?
I think there is a cinematic element to it, but I think it's theatrical. I think that it's like an illusion to think, oh, well, that will, then you could open that up and make it into a film. Every time I think about having to do a film of a play that I've written, my heart sinks. Because I know I don't write plays with 71 scenes in them. You know, I write plays that take place in one location, usually over one day. And the drama, such as it is, comes out of a kind of a pressure cooker vibe. And that's not really good for film. I think opening stuff out, making it bigger, is not usually, like, making jokes longer doesn't really work, does it? Like, you know, brevity is the soul of wit. I think that novels make good films because you have to make them smaller. You have to. It's a limiting process rather than a kind of a diluting process. I think it's kind of misleading to think that a drama on the stage is anyway fit for purpose on the screen. I actually think that one of the ways to do it might be just to film the plays. I think that that's probably the closest you'll get me to go, because I've never attempted. I know what I'm talking about, because I tried to make my first play into a film when I didn't know better, and all I came out with out the sense of that is you know, it was like trying to cook a meal not only with the wrong ingredients, but like with a tennis ball and a you know, and a dishcloth and a Bible and a you know, and a feather. It didn't feel like it was what you would ever put in olive oil and turn the heat up of. You know, it didn't feel like that at all. And as soon as I sat down to try and write a film that wasn't made out of bits of a play, it didn't feel fettered in the same kind of way.
Mm. So what does the future hold, Jez? Is there anything coming up that you can tell me about?
So I am just keep on keeping on. You know, I'm doing film stuff. I'm trying not to write plays. you know, I've got a busy year. I'm doing some television stuff. I'm doing I'm doing an adaptation of a show called The Bureau with Michael Fassbender.
That's right.
That John Henry and I have written, that is shooting this year. I'm writing another TV show, also for Paramount Global and Studio 101, that I'm doing at the moment. And so, yeah, it's a super, super busy time. Very busy. I've got a deadline tomorrow, you know.
Well, I should let you get on and hit that deadline. Jez, this has been such a delight. Thank you so much for your time today.
It's a pleasure. Really, really, really nice to meet you.
You've been listening to Script Apart. Thank you so much for tuning in. A reminder that if you want to help the show continue to grow, you can join us on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/scriptapart or clicking the link in today's show notes. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you next time.